You usually have conversations with some stranger as you don't even know? Despite the antique rural phrasing, I recognize the shark gliding under the surface of that question. Sometimes, I say. I keep it placid. When they're in trouble. And what kind of help can you offer them exactly? Advice. I'm tempted to leave it there and make him chase the rabbit, but I don't. Look, you know who I am and who my ex was. People, mostly women, sometimes reach out in dealing with difficult situations.
Such as?
One woman had a husband who was about to be arrested as a child molester. She didn't know how to deal with it or the fallout. Another woman wanted to do what I did, change her name to protect her kids from harassment. Sometimes I can help them. Mostly I can't. Occasionally I get ones that just need to talk it out.
And Mrs. Crockett?
She wasn't specific about what her problem was. She clearly felt like there was trouble, though I didn't get the impression she thought it was danger to her. She wanted me to come up to Wolf Hunter. She said she'd discuss it here.
I take in a breath, let it out.
To be honest, I thought maybe she suspected someone around her of some crime. That's normally the case.
Did you meet with her?
I see the spark fly through him, like a pilot light flaring up. How much of a career boost would it be for him to somehow pin a woman's murder on the ex of Melvin Royal? No, I did not, I say, still calm. I'm happy for you to look at my cell phone records, which should show you exactly where I've been since then, and I'll give you a detailed timeline in writing. I've never been to Wolf Hunter before we got here late last night. If he's disappointed, he doesn't show it. His helpful expression never shifts.
If you could write that all down for me, that would be real helpful, he says.
He opens a drawer on his side of the table and comes up with a lined yellow pad and a felt-tip pen.
I'll need to ask Mr. Cade for his timeline from when Marlene first called until you got that second call, too.
Of course, he'll be happy to do that and give you access to his cell records as well. I wouldn't normally make that kind of promise on Sam's behalf, but obviously this detective's not stupid. He's going to get court orders and pull them whether we like it or not. Exceeding will give us the edge on credibility.
So what exactly did Mrs. Crockett say when she called you?
He asks me, and shifts a little forward. An invitation to share confidences just between the two of us. He's got a good command of body language. I'll give him that. Not much. She called after we got back from Knoxville, after dinner.
Knoxville, he repeats.
And why'd you go to Knoxville again? I had an appearance on the Howie Hamlin show. It's filmed there. My tone goes sharp again. He gives me a little nod.
Yes, ma'am, I do remember that now.
He must have Googled me already. That would be standard procedure before taking an interview.
And what exactly did she say when she called?
I think back. My memory's not perfect, but it's reasonably good, and I think I recounted well enough for him. He listens without comment. When I pause, he says,
Then why didn't you come to Wolf Hunter when she asked you to?
Because I'm not stupid, I say. I don't go running off to meet in secret with people I don't know. Not unless I do it on my own terms. It might have been a trap.
A trap?
He sits back now.
Set by who, exactly?
I start ticking off the list. Fans of my ex, Absalom members who slipped the net, random internet stalkers, of which I have dozens, not to mention the families of my ex-husband's victims, some of whom still believe I'm complicit. Oh, and all these crazy people stirred up by that mess on the Howie Hamlin train wreck, because now I've got Miranda Tidewell's documentary crew stalking me. So, plenty of suspects.
Sounds like your life is difficult, ma'am.
Not nearly as difficult as the people who lost their loved ones so horribly, I say. Damn sure not as difficult as the lives of my children, who've had to endure more than I can imagine. I'm not wallowing in self-pity
or paranoia. I'm just realistic about the number of people who want to see me humiliated or hurt. Maybe dead. But I'm not the dead one, am I? Can we get back to Marlene? He lets me shift the ground.
Okay. So after that initial call, you had no further contact with her, is that right?
That's right.
Until the call came from her phone.
Yes. I remember the sick sensation of realizing just how badly things had gone on the other end of that phone.
I'd like you to describe that call in detail, ma'am. Be as specific as possible.
So I do. I tell him what V. Crockett said, as best I can recall it. I describe the unsettling way she said it, the panic of the shotgun blast, and thinking that she'd been killed as well.
Ah, he says. Well, that was the postman on the front porch delivering a package. Good thing he was bent over putting it down when she let loose with that shot.
He wasn't hurt?
Ran for his life, Fairweather tells me. Punched a hole the size of his head through the door just above him. He was damn lucky.
I agree. V had meant to kill whoever was on the other side of that door. That doesn't necessarily mean she killed her mother, though.
I haven't said anything about that, Fairweather says. And I'm not here to tell you what I think. Go on. What happened after that?
I told her to put the shotgun down, switch the phone to speaker, and hold up both hands after she opened the front door.
Why not tell her to hang up, or hang up yourself?
Because I felt like she shouldn't be alone, I tell him. She's 15. She'd been through a trauma.
You just described how little that bothered her.
You know that sometimes people react to trauma in odd ways. She called me. I felt I needed to see it through as far as I could. I was afraid. I pause, thinking about whether or not to say it. I was afraid she'd make a mistake and somebody would overreact.
Or she'd provoke them into it. Suicide by cop.
I can't say. I just felt she wasn't thinking clearly. She needed help. He changes tack.
Folks around Wolf Hunters say that Marlene had a sour relationship with that girl, he says. She was into drinking and taking some pills. Trouble at school. She tell you anything about that?
No, I tell him. No specifics, like I told you. I can't help you with that. But honestly, that describes a lot of kids, right?
Yours?
Well, that's a precise little stab.
No.
Not the drinking and pills part, at least. Let's stick to the subject, please. He veers back into timelines, and I tell him point by point up to the minute the phone dropped from Vera's hand, and then add what I've done since. Some of it, inevitably, will be unverifiable. But when paired up with cell records, I think I'll be okay. He asks me then to write it all down. I do. I know the ploy. Ask the questions aloud, then match the written timeline and identify discrepancies, then double-check everything. Detective, I ask. How is she?
Marlene? She's dead.
Vera.
Hospital checked her out. She's just fine. Just not cooperative.
Have you charged her?
I'd be an idiot not to, he says. Nothing she said to you on the phone says she didn't do it. Even then, the physical evidence shows her with fingerprints on the weapon, blood all over her, and gunshot residue.
The gunshot residue comes from the shot I heard.
Maybe. Maybe that was her second target. Two shells, and the gun was empty when we collected it.
Even I am not convinced of the kid's innocence, but this bothers me. Does she even have a lawyer?
Ma'am, I caution you not to get too involved in this. We may never know why her mother called you. Maybe it was because of the very thing that happened, and the person she was afraid of was her own daughter.
That wasn't my question.
The court appointed someone, he says. Hector Sparks. He's local.
He'll be one of the two numbers on my arms, most likely. Can I see her?
He leans back, as if he wants to get as far away from that question as possible.
Why would you want to do that, Miss Proctor? You don't know this girl. You didn't even know her mother.
She's my daughter's age, I say. And she might talk to me. She did on the phone.
He thinks it over, and I believe he's tempted, but then he shakes his head.
Can't allow someone without legal standing to visit until she's been held over for trial.
What if her lawyer's present?
Well, he says, if her lawyer's present and you have his permission, then it's privileged communication as long as you're working with him in some capacity. Otherwise, no decent lawyer would allow it.
There's a strange emphasis, the way he puts that, and something I can't quite unwrap. I let it go. Okay, I say. What if she asks to see me?
Don't put ideas in that girl's head, he tells me. She's not the fragile little thing you seem to think she is, and I guarantee you she doesn't need your protection.
Funny, I say. I remember the same things being said about me when I was in jail, waiting for my trial. Fairweather doesn't respond to that. He stops the recorder on his phone, pockets the device, and stands up to open the door.
All right, ma'am, he says. Well, I thank you kindly for your assistance. Would you mind if I contact you again if I have some more questions?
No, sir. I don't mind at all. Aren't we just the picture of Southern cordiality? He gives me his business card.
Don't forget to email me permission to get your cell phone records and have Mr. Cade send me a timeline and the same letter granting permission. It speeds things up considerably.
I'm not sure speeding things up is in that girl's best interest, I tell him. You seem to be moving awfully fast already.
Just because it looks like an open and shut case doesn't mean I won't put in the work. But I don't expect any twists in this story, Miss Proctor. Bad blood between them. Marlene even reached out to you for help on her situation, and it blew up before she could get it.
His expression loses a little of its aw shucks country boy charm.
And the longer I'm on this case means the less time I put in looking for that little girl.
Ellie White, I say. The kidnapping. Were you on the task force?
Until this, miss, he says.
I hope you find her.
With respect, ma'am, I'm almost hoping I'm not the one who does, he says, because that girl is almost certainly dead.
Chapter 8. Sam. After we drop Gwen off, and I hate leaving her there alone, I take the kids back to the motel. Connor is fidgeting with the desire to get at his assigned job, tracking down the case of the missing young women of Wolf Hunter. Lanny tries to pretend she's massively uninterested, but I know she is. She also asks a lot about V. Crockett, which worries me a little. Normally, Lanny can be skeptical and a pretty good judge of character, but there's something about V's situation that seems to have gotten past her natural defenses. Maybe it's the fact that she's afraid Dahlia Brown's getting tired of their relationship. Teens run hot as hell, then cold as ice, and that's normal. But V's not someone I'd like her to be fascinated with. Not, I remind myself, that I have any say in the matter. I may be in the household, but I'm not family. No matter how much I'd like to be. Lanny, predictably, tells Connor he's going to have to wait an hour, grabs her laptop, and asks me if she can use my room to call Dahlia. I tell her yes and leave her alone for whatever drama plays out. Connor, grumpy, loses himself in a book, and I check messages on my phone, leaning back in the armchair in the corner of their room. It's under an hour when Lanny comes through the connecting doors and hands her laptop to Connor. Here, she says. Keep it. She flops onto the other bed and rolls over on her side. She sounds angry and hurt, and I turn my attention to her as Connor shrugs and starts mining for internet gold. She's been crying, no question. Her eyeliner's a mess, her cheeks flushed, and from the red in her eyes, she's been at it a while. I sit down beside her, but far enough away that she doesn't feel like I'm in her space. So, I say, what's up? Nothing. She sniffles wetly and shoots me a sidelong glance. Have you ever been dumped? Ooh, boy, this is that conversation. I briefly wish her mom was here, but she isn't, and I am. So I say, yeah, absolutely. And? There was a girl. Her name was Jillian. When was this? High school. Was she beautiful? Did you love her? She was gorgeous, and yeah, for a while. Then one day she just wasn't interested anymore. Next thing I know, she's dating someone else on the same baseball team. Well, that's awkward, Lanny says. Especially when she told everybody I'd been sleeping around on her. This time I get the whole stare. Did you? No, but that's what she said. I shrug. It happens. My foster mom once told me she got thrown out of a car on a date with her boyfriend and had to walk a mile back to town in heels in the dark. That's how her breakup happened. Seriously? Lanny blinks. He just left her? When you say dumped, she got dumped, right by the side of the road, I say. She told me she never wore high heels on a date again, so I didn't feel so bad after that. I guess. The way she says it means she doesn't believe she'll ever feel good again. I remember those years where everything came in overwhelming waves and was destined to last forever. There's a lot great about it, even more that's dangerous. Something happened with Dahlia, I say, which isn't a genius guess. She takes a deep breath and lowers her voice to a tense whisper. She doesn't want to say this with Connor in the room, clearly.
Dahlia says she can't see me anymore. Her mom's pissed off about the rumors going around, the documentary, all that crap, and she thinks I'm a bad influence or something. It's not even my fault.
It may not be permanent. Let things settle. But that's adult advice, and I know it feels useless to her. Did she say she'd still talk to you?
Yeah.
Lanny blinks back more tears.
When her mom wasn't home, then maybe it'll work out. Maybe.
Lanny doesn't sound too optimistic. She scoots closer and leans her hand against my shoulder. I put my arm around her.
Thanks.
Anytime, kid. These rumors she mentioned. Like, what kind of rumors?
That Mom helped Melvin kill people. That she's some kind of sicko.
She swallows when her voice falters on that last part.
Your mom had a fair trial. She was acquitted, not guilty. Yeah? Tell that to the sicko patrol that follows us around on the internet,
Lanny says.
They still believe she's guilty. It ruins everything.
I think about Miranda. The Lost Angels. She's absolutely right. Some things leave a stain, even after all the scrubbing in the world. I feel it like a slow knife to the guts, because I also know how much guilt I bear for that.
Sam?
Connor's voice. I look over at him.
Maybe you should look at this?
I kiss the side of Lanny's head and go over to him to see what he's got. He swivels the laptop toward me.
That's something, right?
A third young woman, reported missing not from Wolf Hunter, but from the Daniel Boone National Forest that Wolf Hunter clings on the edge of like a burr. I pick up the laptop. It's another entry like the ones he found before. Same blog. Another woman missing from near Wolf Hunter. Earlier I discovered the suspicious disappearance of Tarla Dawes, 18, then Bethany Wardrip, 21. Now there's another one, Sandra Klegman, who lives in Sioux City, Iowa, but was vacationing in the nearby Daniel Boone National Forest. Her friend saw her zipped up in her tent one night, and she was missing the next morning, leaving behind everything she had brought with her, including wallet and cash. People get lost in the woods, but Sandra Klegman was a country girl with a history of camping in forests, and the idea that she wandered off to be eaten by bears without a trace is pretty sketchy if you ask me. Forest rangers conducted a thorough search, along with the state police, and even some FBI. No traces were found, not a drop of blood or a snag of fabric on a branch. Sandra Clegman, like Tarla and Bethany, just vanished. If you draw a circle from the center of Wolf Hunter, Tennessee, with a 10-mile circumference, you'll find all three of these disappearances fall inside that circle. I made a call to the Wolf Hunter PD and asked what they thought. They told me I was talking about two runaways and a hiker who probably had a bad fall and died in the wilderness. Nothing to see here, move along. Well, I'm not moving along, because something's off.
It's weird, right?
Connor says.
Three women now. That can't be just luck, can it?
Well, strangely enough, it can, I tell him. Weird things happen, but more than that, the police may actually believe something's wrong and not want to put the word out to the public just yet. There could be an investigation going on that this blogger doesn't know about. He doesn't seem thrilled with that.
I still think it's weird.
I'm not saying it isn't, I tell him. Keep looking. You could be onto something. He nods, a little happier, and I give him back the laptop. I check my watch. Gwen's been at the police station for 2 hours now, and I haven't gotten any calls from her. I wonder if she decided to use the traditional one phone call, presuming they offered, they're not required to, for a lawyer, and she trusts me to call and ask after her. I'm going to check on Mom, I tell the kids, and walk into the other room. I close the connecting door and dial her cell. I get voicemail. I leave a message asking her to check in, and then I look up Wolf Hunter PD's central number in the tiny phone book on the nightstand. I get a smooth southern voice asking me how to direct my call, and I ask if I can speak to Gwen Proctor. She hesitates, then transfers me without another word, this time a male voice.
Detective Ben Fairweather, who's this?
Sam Cade, I say. I was looking for Gwen Proctor.
Hello, Mr. Cade, nice to talk to you. I had a good chat with Ms. Proctor, but she left out of here about 10 minutes back.
I don't like that.
Heading where? Most likely to see Vera Crockett's defense lawyer, he says. You got time to stop in and give me a statement? I understand you were in the room when Ms. Proctor took that call from Vera. I'd like to get your account of it, and a timeline for the past 48 hours or so.
He sounds friendly and reasonable. I don't like it, and I don't trust it.
Sure, I say. Later today, once Gwen's back, I can't leave the kids.
Of course.
He pauses.
So you all came up.
Family trip, I say. We might visit the forest. Almost certainly not, but it gives a decent excuse. If Gwen hasn't mentioned it, I don't want him digging into reasons we left Stillhouse Lake. Miranda's crew is, I hope, still in Norton. They'll have a lot to say. Some of it might even be true.
Okay, he says. How about two? That okay for you?
I'll give you a call, I tell him. I just need to find Gwen first. We end it politely, and I find a note from Gwen with two lawyers' phone numbers that Kez had texted her sitting on the bedside table. I call the first one, and I get a recording by what sounds like an ancient man who says he's out of the office. The second one gets a pickup and a crisp greeting.
Hector Sparks's office. This is Mrs. Paul. May I help you?
There's something about it that sets me back a little, and it takes a second for me to identify what it is. Mrs. Paul. Not many women answer the phone with that form of address in the office anymore. They normally use their first names.
Hi, I was wondering if Mr. Sparks might be having a meeting with a woman named Gwen Proctor. She was heading over to talk with him. Is she there?
May I ask who's calling him, please?
She sounds very uptight.
Sam Cade, I say.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Cade, but Mr. Sparks's meetings are strictly private, and I won't be able to confirm that for you.
Then can I speak to him?
I'm afraid not, she says. He's asked not to be disturbed, but I will give him a message that you called.
And if Gwen is there, please ask her to call me, I say. She doesn't acknowledge that at all.
Thanks. You're welcome,
she says, but not in any way that makes me feel it, and hangs up the call. I open up the connecting door again. Lanny's lying on her bed, headphones on, looking miserable. When she sees me, she turns her back. I don't push it.
Connor, I say, can you look somebody up, get a little background?
Sure.
Hector Sparks, I say. He's an attorney here in town.
I just want to know a little more before... Before what exactly? There's no real reason for it, but something about that conversation set me on edge. Just like the one with Ben Fairweather. Maybe it's this town, missing women, a dead mother and a jailed daughter. Wolf Hunter just doesn't seem safe for Gwen. And I feel like having her out there on her own is dangerous.
Okay, he says. I'm on it.
It takes him about 15 minutes to report back that Hector Sparks is an attorney who lives in town. He gives me the address. And his father was a lawyer, too. Connor's found a couple of local newspaper articles he shows me, old ones, since the local newspaper expired years ago. And it all seems normal enough. One of the articles has a picture of a surprisingly nice large house that seems like far better construction than the normal Wolf Hunter real estate. Old, too, maybe built in the early 1900s. A family posing in front, an old man in a wheelchair, a son standing tall next to him. A mother and daughter are also in the photo, but they're off to the side, definitely just bystanders to the men's special moment. The mother's expression is blank, the daughter's looking away. It's an odd photo to put into a newspaper, even one as amateurish as this publication obviously was. The write-up is clumsy, but it's apparently celebrating the retirement of the father, Donald, and the takeover of the attorney business by the son, Hector. The women aren't even mentioned in the caption beyond, accompanied by wife and daughter. The dateline is 1992, but the sentiment is pure 1950s. But the point is, Hector Sparks is legit, and I shouldn't be worrying about Gwen. Yet I am. I text her. Even if she has her phone on silent, she usually answers within a few minutes. Then I sit straight up, staring, because I have a voicemail that's come in while I was on the phone. I know that number from memory. It's Miranda Nelson Tidwell, and immediately on seeing it on my screen, I'm plunging off a cliff into an abyss. Hey, I say to Connor. Gotta make a call, okay? I'll be right next door. He nods, not even taking his eyes from the page, but I think he looks when I turn away. He probably notices my tension. I leave quickly and take some deep breaths standing in the room I'm sharing with Gwen. The connecting door is shut. I realize it feels warm in here, so I get the air conditioning going again. Then I place the call that will send me straight to hell. Miranda doesn't say hello. She never does.
Sam, did you even listen to my message?
No, I tell her. My voice sounds different when I talk to this woman. I can't remember if that's always been true. What the hell are you doing?
I think the real question is, what do you think you're doing, Sam? You're living in her house, in her bed. That is, without any question at all, the most monstrously perverted thing I've heard in years, and my God, that's quite saying something.
Her voice. It's both honey and ice, a hint of huskiness. Still, while she was being treated for a breakdown after her daughter's murder, she screamed so much she permanently altered it. Her damage starts there, but it's just a hint of the chasm underneath. Miranda is rich, a multimillionaire, the ex-wife of a hedge fund manager, a former junior leaguer who'd had life handed to her on a succession of silver platters, until the day her daughter, Vivian, disappeared at the mall, the second of Melvin Royal's known victims. She'd met me at the airport, coming home from deployment. I'd still been in my fatigues. She'd looked like a perfectly composed mannequin draped in designer fashions, holding a sign with my name printed on it.
"We have something in common, Mr. Cade," she had said. "My daughter and your sister. Let me drive you. We'll talk."
I'd been shell-shocked, raw, angry, devastated, and vulnerable at that time in my life. And Miranda had been far worse than I was, the toxic relationship we had formed. I've seen her unkempt, messy, wearing clothes that stank of days of drinking bouts. I've carried her back into her three-story, 6,000-square-foot mansion and helped her to the toilet when she needed to vomit. I've listened to her rages. I've taught her how to shoot a gun. We've done awful things together.
"How did you get this number?"
I ask her. That's not the most urgent question, but it's the only one I can stand to ask at the moment.
"Money and contacts,"
she says, and I hear the amusement in the words. It's her answer to most things.
"You're not at home, I know. I visited there yesterday, along with my film crew. I did leave a note. I even signed my name, remember? Did you tell her that?
I hadn't. I had taken the goddamn note and run it through the shredder. When I don't respond, she keeps going.
Where exactly are you hiding, Sam?
I'm not hiding, I tell her. It's half true, anyway. And we've got nothing to talk about except how you're gonna back the fuck off and leave us alone.
Us.
The contempt and scorn in the word feels like a lash against my back.
My God, Sam, really? This is insane.
It's not your business, I say. Go home to Kansas City, Miranda. Let it go.
I sold the house in Kansas City. I'm, what's the popular phrase these days? Property surfing. Though I have to admit, I had to spend a very unpleasant evening at that local bed and breakfast in Norton. And I won't be going there again. I understand there are some reasonably adequate houses for rent out at Stillhouse Lake. Maybe you can recommend the one you used to have.
I don't answer. I can't. The idea of Miranda, with millions to spend and the leisure to indulge her hate, holing up like a venomous spider within striking distance, it's honestly horrifying. I know Miranda. I know she was out of control when I left her. If she's abandoned her old life in Kansas City, all her creature comforts and enablers and sympathetic friends, then God only knows what she's planning.
You didn't answer me,
she says.
Is this some kind of game you're playing, pretending to be in a relationship with her? I really hope it is, because the alternative makes me want to vomit.
Let's not do this, I tell her. Come on.
So it's true, you're actually sleeping with her. She was Melvin Royal's wife, for God's sake. Hurt her, yes, by all means, but don't debase yourself.
I don't want to talk to Miranda about Gwen. My past is a wrecking ball. I've always known it was out there, rushing toward me. I just never imagined how much it would hurt when it finally hit. I'm only going to say this once, I tell her. So believe that I mean every word. If you come for her, you come through me. You make even a move toward hurting those kids, and I will end you. They don't deserve any of this. Gwen, the kids, they're innocent. Just leave it alone. Just stop. She's silent for so long that I think I've actually gotten through to her. Then she says,
she's really turned your head inside out. Oh, my God, she's good at making otherwise sensible men believe her, including the ones on her jury. We swore to make her pay. I thought you believed in that.
She sounds almost sorry for me. She's right. I'd believed every word of that at the time I'd met her. I've moved past it, but nothing's changed in Miranda's life. She's frozen in the amber of her grief and rage, obsessed with reliving her dead child's last moments. Revenge is not my life. I don't want it to be, not anymore. Even after reading Callie's journal, especially after that, because I can see myself ending up like Miranda, broken, cord hollow, filled with rage if I step off that cliff. I don't mean it to hurt when I say, I'm sorry for you, Miranda, I really am. But from the sharp intake of breath on the other end, it does sting, deeply. Please stop, I'm asking you, please. If we ever had any kind of feelings between us, please don't do this.
I'm only talking to you because we did have that, she says. One chance. You're better than this. Just walk away from that woman, even if you don't help me. Or I swear to you, the price you pay for it will be very, very high.
I think of Gwen sobbing in my arms, waking from nightmares that she can't talk about, defending her kids despite her own danger. And saving me, too. Gwen isn't perfect by any stretch, but she's a damn sight more real and alive and human than Miranda, whose malevolence is the only thing keeping her broken heart beating. Okay, you can say you gave me a chance if that makes you sleep at night, I say. If you're coming at me, do your fucking worst. I hang up on her. That probably drives her wild. Miranda's used to cursing, but only when she's the one doing it. And she's a narcissist. She hates to be ignored. She's lived in a padded box her whole life, handled carefully like a breakable treasure. When reality crashed in on her, she could only believe that her pain, her loss, was bigger and more urgent than anyone else's. and that will never change. I felt something for her once, not tenderness, not love, but a shared delusion that expresses itself in violence is almost more intimate than love. Miranda Tidewell is back. I know she's not going away. And everything I've built, everything I love, is about to come crashing down on top of me.
Sam.
I look up. Lanny's standing in the doorway of the room that Gwen and I are sharing. She's got her phone in her hand, holds it up. I see there's a call open. She hands it to me. I lift the phone to my ear, and Miranda's voice says,
"Did you really think it would be that easy?"
I know Lanny can see me flinch, and I quickly turn my back to her and say, "You just called a child's phone to make a point. Well, I get it. Trust that. What the hell do you want? What is your endgame here?"
"I have all your numbers," she says. "Would you rather I call Gina next, or are you going to come out and talk to me face to face?"
She refuses to call Gwen by any name other than her old one. I swallow hard. I'm shaking. I can feel it. "Where are you?"
"Outside in the parking lot of your motel," she says. "I'm in a rented Buick. Definitely not my style, I know. But this isn't Lexus rental territory."
Shit, shit, shit. She tracked our phones. Of course she did. We got careless about changing them. If she got our numbers, it'd be easy as hell for her to pinpoint our locations. Norton's not that far away, and we're sitting ducks inside this room. "I could have you arrested for stalking," I say.
"Really?"
She laughs. It sounds half crazy.
"And are you going to explain what we are to each other, to the police? Maybe you should also confess all the illegal things you got up to while you were with me. Stalking, as I recall, was also involved."
I look over my shoulder. Lanny's still there, frowning, trying to listen. I walk over and close the door. I'm struggling just to keep it together. "Leave," I tell Miranda.
"No. You didn't just screw me over, Sam. Oh, no. You fucked over your dead sister and my dead daughter and all those other dead girls, too. That's how low you are, and how much of a gullible coward. Come out and face me."
I go to the door that opens out to the parking lot, put my hand on the knob. It's as warm as blood, easy to turn. I make myself stop. And I crouch down, still holding it, breathing hard against the impulse to go out there, break her windows, beat the holy living shit out of the car, if not the woman inside it. Because that's what she wants, a confrontation, one that gives her something to use.
"Sam?"
I can barely hear her over the ringing in my ears. Christ. She knows how to push my buttons. She learned that over those years we nursed our grudges together. Hand-fed them on diets of hatred and booze and still bleeding wounds. She remembers.
"The longer you wait, the worse this is going to get. Understand?"
I stand and pull open the door. There she is, Miranda, unmistakable behind the wheel of her running blue Buick. And she's right. The car is too pedestrian for her, even on this trip to nowhere. Her hair looks perfectly styled, her makeup perfectly applied. I've seen her raw and desperate and agonized, stumbling and screaming, but this Miranda is her public face, rich, entitled, and proud of it. I don't go out. She sits in the car. We stare at each other for a long, long moment as heat shimmers up between us, and I lift the phone back to my ear and say, "I'm done." I shut the door and hang up the call. I turn to put my back against the wood and slide down until I'm sitting. A human shield between her and the kids, because she'll come for me first. She'll have to. I don't know what I'm expecting. Gunfire through the door, maybe? I know she's got it in her. But I hear a change in the pitch of the Buick's engine. It's backing out. Then I hear it drive away. Lanny's knocking on the connecting door, urgently.
"Sam! Sam, are you okay?"
I get up and open it. I hand the phone back to her. "Block that number," I tell her. "Do the same for Connor's phone, okay? I don't want you talking to her."
"Who is she?"
She's eyeing me warily, and I can't say I blame her. I probably don't look like the same man who listened to her breakup story.
"Is she... she's not..."
"An old girlfriend?" I finish for her, because that's normally where she'd go. She nods.
No. Someone I used to work with.
You sounded so angry, though.
Yeah. The job didn't end well. Not that it's ended at all. Miranda's right about one thing. Sooner or later, I'm going to have to face her. And sooner or later, I'm going to have to tell Gwen what I've been holding back from her before Miranda does it for me.
Chapter 9. Gwen. Everything in Wolf Hunter is a short walk, even in the heat. Hector Sparks has a lush old place, probably one of the nicest in Wolf Hunter. It's a private home with a carefully tended garden bursting with flowers, bushes trimmed to precise measurements, trees that don't have a leaf out of place. Since I can't see a lawyer, even in this little burg, having the leisure to tend such a thing, he either has a brilliant full-time gardener or a spouse with a green thumb and lots of free time. There's a shiny, but discreet, polished brass plaque on the lawn that says, Hector J. Sparks, Esquire, and beneath that, even more discreetly, attorney at law. This isn't a guy who feels the need to plaster his face on a park bench or advertise on late-night television. He has to be very high-priced to afford this lifestyle. And living in Wolf Hunter? Interesting. I stop and check the address on my phone and realize that I've missed a couple of calls. Coverage in this town is shitty, dropping in and out every block or so. One is from Sam, and one is from Lanny. I listen to Lanny's voicemail first. She's sobbing her heart out about Dahlia, which is what I was afraid would happen. I want to call her back, go back to her, but first I switch over to Sam's voicemail. He sounds worried about where I am, so I call. He answers on the first ring. Gwen? He sounds tense as hell. Yeah, I say. I'm okay, about to go in to talk to Vera Crockett's attorney. Thank God, he says, or I think he does. It's fast and almost a mumble. Okay, well, I tried to call there, and the dragon lady who answers his phone wouldn't confirm whether or not you were there. She'd only say he was in a meeting. And you're concerned because you don't think I can look after myself? I'm strangely touched. No, I'm concerned because we're in a town where women disappear, he says. And I don't want you on that list, Gwen. Now I'm charmed, and also a little annoyed. Do you seriously think I would end up there? No. He pulls in a deep breath and lets it out, as if struggling with what he wants to say next. Connor's working on stuff for you to look over. Anything you want me to do? Just watch out for them, I say. Thank you. I know you'll protect the kids, whatever might come. I don't say that about many people. Two others, to be exact, and in truth, I only entrusted Connor and Lanny to Javier and Kezia because Sam couldn't stay to do it. He thought my safety was just as important, and that's something I need to remind myself of more. They're okay, though? I ask when he falls silent. Lanny's got a bit of a broken heart, he says. Connor's enthusiasm for researching crime is scaring me a little. They're great, though. As they always are. I feel my throat tighten. I have strong kids who care about others despite everything that's been done to them. They're watchful and guarded. But beneath that, they have real empathy. It's a gift that must have come from heaven because I'm not arrogant enough to think it's something they got from me. Hey, Sam? Yeah? Everything okay with you? I ask because I can feel him holding back. I can hear the tension even when I don't see it. Did something happen? No, he says, and this time he almost sounds normal. It's just, I have a bad feeling, so watch your back, please. I will, I tell him. I'd like to leave tonight, he says. We already paid, though. I know, I just... He makes a sound that's all frustration. No words. Damn it. I don't know that going home is much of an answer either. The documentary crew isn't going to give up. Fucking Miranda. No wonder he's edgy. Okay, let's stay here tonight and decide tomorrow, I tell him. Sam, It's okay. I promise. He doesn't ask how the hell I can promise, and I'm really glad because I damn sure don't know. I tell him I love him. He says he loves me too. I carry that inner warmth on the walk up the broad, clean sidewalk and up the front steps onto the wraparound veranda. Bees drift lazily between the flowers, drunk on nectar, and the thick smell of hyacinth and roses mixes in a powerful cloud. I ring, and the door's answered in 10 seconds by a raw-boned woman of middle age who seems like she'd have been more comfortable in a farmhouse on the prairie during westward expansion, or, to give it the real definition, westward invasion. She's got long hair piled up on her head and a sharply angular face, and is wearing, of all things, a full apron, the kind that loops around her neck and goes down to her knees. It looks like a costume. Beneath that, she's wearing a flowered dress with a high collar and long sleeves, even in the summer. "Yes," she says doubtfully, looking me up and down as intently as I'm appraising her. "Hi, I'm here to see Mr. Sparks," I tell her. "Mr. Sparks is not currently seeing new clients." "I'm not a new client, ma'am. I'm just in town for the day, and I need to talk to him about Marlene Crockett's daughter, Vera. V. Mr. Sparks does not speak with journalists without an appointment." "Oh, come on. I'm not a journalist. I hate to do it, but there are times when my dark celebrity comes in handy. My name is Gwen Proctor. I'm the ex-wife of Melvin Royal. Perhaps you can ask him if he'd like to see me?" She blinks again, and without a change in expression says, "Please wait a moment." The door shuts again, but it is more of a gentle motion than a slam, and I do as instructed. After less than a minute, the door opens, but it's not the housekeeper/dragon lady. It's an older man with silver-gray hair, slightly darker on top than on the sides. He's wearing a nicely pressed, blazingly white dress shirt, a paisley tie, and suit pants. He even has suspenders to match the tie, and all of it probably costs more than I've ever spent on my entire wardrobe. He smiles and holds out his hand. "Miss Proctor," he says, and raises both eyebrows. "You do prefer Miss, am I correct? I confess, I've read up about your, history. I never thought we'd meet face to face." I shake and nod. "I'm here about Marlene and V. Crockett." The smile vanishes, and it's his turn to nod. "Yes, please come in. It will not be a long conversation, I'm afraid." The hallway smells of fresh, lemon-scented polish, and the hardwood floor is spotless. There's surprisingly colorful art on the walls, mostly of gardens, but I don't get time to admire it as I follow Mr. Sparks down the hall and into a spacious office. This one has a gigantic red Persian rug covering most of the floor, gently holding a large antique desk and 3 matching leather-bound chairs. The room has a reassuring smell of furniture polish, with a faint undertone of tobacco, and against my will, I breathe it in deeply. My mother used to use the same lemon-scented polish. My childhood memories are drenched in it, along with my father's sweet pipe smoke. Mr. Sparks congenially offers me one of the chairs and sits behind his desk. He rocks slightly for a moment before he says, "Where are my manners? Can I offer you coffee, iced tea? I believe Mrs. Paul has made up a cream cake, if you'd like some." "Thank you, no, I'm fine." "I'm tempted by the cream cake." "Very well. Please explain how you became involved in this matter, Miss Proctor." Like any good lawyer, he's asking me to verify what he already knows. "Her mother called me," I say. "And I'm concerned about what's happening here. Because from what I got out of the phone call, Marlene didn't seem frightened that her own daughter was going to kill her." "You were also an ear witness, so to speak, to what happened with Vera. Isn't that the case? Detective Fairweather told me he intended to take your statement." His accent has its roots in the wolf hunter drawl, but it's a little less antique. He must have gone away to school and consciously struggled with it. Southern accents can be a real barrier in some places. I look around for the degree. Almost every lawyer has it framed and on the wall. And there it is, off to the right of his desk. But there's a glare on the glass from the window. I can't tell what school he attended. Yes, and I gave a statement this morning, I say. I assume they'll share it with you. Always nice to know what to look for in case someone overlooks it. And let me ask you a pointed question. Do you think the girl committed this awful crime? I don't know, I tell him. Detective Fairweather wouldn't let me talk to her, which is too bad, because I felt like we had something of a rapport on the phone. At least enough to get her through it alive. You likely did save her life, Sparks says. Our local police are not exactly highly trained. She was lucky, especially since people already knew there was trouble between her and her mother. I finish it for him, because it seems like he's trying to imply without committing himself. I know that. Interesting, Sparks says. He rolls his leather chair a little forward and folds his hands together. I'm struck by his incredibly neat, precise desk. An inbox, or maybe an outbox, with just one folder in it. A miniature bronze of Lady Justice, complete with blindfold and scales. A small gavel with some kind of memorial plate. A desk set of pen holder and leather desk protector, both looking impeccable. There's only one pen in the container. I don't know why, but that strikes me as eccentric, bordering on odd. So, let's back up. When Marlene Crockett called you, she seemed afraid of someone? Yes, or some situation. She wasn't specific, I say. Not even a guess. Just that she seemed to be having a crisis and wouldn't give me details unless I came up to talk in person. Which you did not do. No. He cocks his head slightly. Why not? I think of a million defensive excuses, but I say, honestly, I didn't want to put myself in the middle of something. After the business last year. Yes, I can understand you're wanting to stay out of the spotlight. He doesn't mention the disastrous Howie Hamlin TV appearance, though I'm sure he's aware of it. I assume you also considered that it might be a trap set to lure you to Wolf Hunter, an out-of-the-way place where you might well be caught without support? Well, yes, I did. But you don't think that's the case now? I blink. Marlene's dead. She clearly did have something to fear. That doesn't mean it isn't still a trap, just that the bait is bigger. Hector Sparks sits back in his chair and lowers his chin as he stares at me. He's about to say something when I hear a distant banging, rhythmic, like someone hammering in a nail. Banging a pipe? Annoyance flickers across his face. He picks up the phone sitting at precise angles in the corner of his desk and dials. Mrs. Paul, please get on the intercom and ask maintenance to keep the noise down, if you please. He hangs up. Apologies, it's an old house. Repairs are simply never ending. Of course, I say. It's beautiful. You keep it in great condition. Thank you. Well, it's been in the family for a very long time. Something about that seems to give him a flicker of amusement. But then it's gone, and he's back to seriousness. I just want to be clear about what Vera Crockett is facing in this county. They intend to arraign her for first-degree murder and try her as an adult. She may not have much of a defense unless I can find some alibi witnesses to show she could not possibly have done the deed. The banging comes to an abrupt halt. Mrs. Paul is efficient. Mr. Sparks visibly relaxes. Ah, that's better. Miss Proctor, I have a somewhat unusual request to make. About... I'd like you to speak with Vera. I'll accompany you. Everything she tells you will be covered by attorney-client privilege, and you will be acting as my agent in this matter. You're purely there as a facilitator. I'm willing to pay you a generous fee as an assistant to help me get her full story. He shakes his head, a chagrined look coming over that kindly face.
She just doesn't like me, I'm afraid, but I'm all she's got. She talked to you, reached out to you, in fact. I don't have a lot of time if I'm going to start tracking down an alibi for her.
Wolf Hunter can't be that big, I say.
You don't know this town. Vera's reputation was already, let's call it, damaged. This place is quick to make judgments and close ranks. If I don't find her witnesses quickly, then I might not be able to get them on the record at all.
I don't want to be drawn into this any deeper. I'm not sure I actually want to help V. Crockett. She unnerved me on that call. But she's 15, and alone, and he's right. Small towns like this don't forgive, or forget. Mr. Sparks, this case could draw media attention, and I'd rather not get caught up in it.
Understandable. Given your, current notoriety, it will only be one conversation, I promise, and then our business will be done, and you'll leave her defense in my hands. Does that sound all right?
When I don't immediately answer, he drops his voice a little into a warmer, slower register.
She's your daughter's age, more or less, and she's trapped in a nightmare. All alone except for what I can offer. And if I'm to give her any hope of avoiding conviction, maybe even the death penalty, I need your help. All I've got to work with right now is a girl who was in the room with her dead mother, covered in her mother's blood, with her prints on the shotgun that killed Marlene. And I'm assuming she didn't say anything to you that would have exonerated her.
I shake my head. And even with all that, you still don't think she did it? I make it a question. Sparks's expression stays carefully neutral.
I believe she deserves a chance to prove she didn't, he says. But she won't speak to me to assist in her own defense. You could be the key to helping her.
I don't think the police will welcome me back.
I can't imagine you're a great deal concerned with what the police want. I'll get you inside. If you make a good faith effort but V still refuses to talk, then keep my payment and be on your way with a clear conscience.
I think about that, and then asked, why did you take her case? You must have known the town would be against you. He's silent for a moment, a long one. Then he slowly leans forward with a creak of springs in his leather chair and spears me with a look I can't read.
I didn't choose it, he says. I was assigned the case. Believe me, I'd rather not be responsible for it, but here we are. Do we have an agreement?
We do. When he writes me a check from the thick ledger for $1,000, I get the oddest feeling that he's buying more than my time. But a grand is nothing I can refuse, especially now. I have no idea how he's going to be reimbursed for this, if he ever is, but I'm not going to turn it down if he's willing to offer. And besides, I do want to get Vera to tell her story. I want to know. So I take the check, and now I'm hired.
May I have your cell number?
He asks, and I write it down for him. As I hand it over, my sleeve rides up, and he sees the Sharpie marks on my arm. His silvery eyebrows climb.
Is that my phone number?
In case I was detained by the cops, I tell him.
How enterprising. I expect to have our interview set for the afternoon, he says. Thank you, Miss Proctor. I appreciate your willingness to help.
As I leave, Mrs. Paul is standing in the foyer as if she's a robot who plugs into the socket there. Her gaze follows me. I can't resist. I hear you have cream cake, I tell her. Any chance I can get some to go? She glares at me without answering, but then I didn't expect a gracious parting gift. I'm just enjoying twisting her tail. Suddenly she smiles and says,
have a very good day, Mrs. Royal.
Proctor, I tell her.
Oh, yes, of course. I quite forgot.
In a pig's eye. Then the door shuts. and I can't work out which one of us won that. I frown at the shiny surface for a long moment. Something's off with that woman. I've no idea what it is, other than general weird unlikability. Not really my problem. The only reasonable thing to do while I'm waiting for Hector Sparks's call, though, is to go to the motel, talk to Sam, and maybe get some clarity on what's making him so twitchy. When I call him, he sounds clipped but normal, and it's a brief call. I wait outside on Hector Sparks's perfectly ordered lawn for 5 minutes until the SUV glides up. Sam's in it by himself, and I get in quickly and stare at him while I fasten my seatbelt.
You left them alone?
Yeah, I did, he says. I needed to talk to you. It's 10 minutes, Gwen. Lanny's on guard.
Okay,
I say. But it isn't, not really. Private talk. This sounds dire. He plunges right into it. Gwen, I need you to seriously think about moving away from Stillhouse Lake, because Miranda Tidewell is not going to give up on this.
You sound like you actually know her.
He doesn't answer immediately.
You do?
I'm taken aback. I don't know how to feel about that. It's certainly not my right to police who he knows, but that woman. I do, he says it quietly, and I can read how reluctant he is to admit it. We connected after I got back from my last deployment. She met me at the airport, helped me reacclimate to civilian life and figure out how to deal with Callie's murder. I feel a real twinge of anger, and I bury it. Or try to. Sam, if the two of you were lovers, just come out with it already. I hate that I feel a surge of jealousy, but I can't deny it either. No, it wasn't like that, he says. Look, we talked before about how I was part of the pack of stalkers that came after you online, but not the full extent of what I did, or how. She knows, and she's going to use it.
Use it how?
To destroy us, he says. I turn and give him a really long look.
Can she?
He doesn't do more than glance my way, then turns his attention back to the road. We're making a turn onto the main street already, 5 blocks, more or less, to the motel. It seems a long way, suddenly. She's capable of doing anything to fill that bottomless hole where her soul used to be, he says. Melvin did that to her. She's dangerous, Gwen. To you, to the kids, maybe. I need you to understand and think how we're going to protect against that.
Is she physically dangerous?
I honestly don't know. I feel like I don't know where to look for trouble anymore. It's not just watching my back, your back. It's watching everything.
We've always known that, I say. Always. 360, 365.
That means 360 degrees of awareness, 365 days a year. Our personal code, and it hasn't failed us yet.
It feels like there are still things you're not telling me. Am I wrong?
No, he says and takes in a deep breath. I also got an outreach from a company in Florida. They're looking for a private pilot to work standby. Good salary, benefits, the whole package. I'm ashamed that the first thing I feel is a deep fear that he's found a reason to leave me. Leave us. I quickly throttle that back and say,
Congratulations. Are you thinking about taking the job?
That sounds accusatory. I can't help it. I wasn't, not seriously, he says. Not until Miranda showed up.
Do you really think she can't find you in Florida? She tracked us down at Stillhouse Lake.
I turn and look at the ramshackle, fading town of Wolf Hunter as it glides past the window. The despair it emanates burns down my nerves.
I said I wasn't going to run anymore.
I know you said that, but circumstances have changed.
Have they? Do you really think I'm more afraid of an angry, grieving mother than I was of my murderous ex who skinned women? I said I'm not running. I won't. I talk tough. I feel like I need to right now. Because the undeniable truth is that if Sam does take that job in Florida, if he leaves us, I don't know what that means. We've been so careful about not putting names and labels on what we have that I don't even know what I'd be losing. Except everything. I swallow hard. Sam, I can't do this. Not now. We can talk about it later, he says. And I know he's struggling with this too. Probably more than I am, if that's possible. Okay, how'd this morning go? Interestingly, I say, and I'm 1,000% relieved to change the subject. I'm going back with Vera Crockett's lawyer to see her this afternoon. He's having some trouble getting a statement, and I might be able to get her to talk more freely. Okay. He doesn't seem thrilled. So we leave tomorrow? Yeah. I pause. Is that all right? Fine, he says. I don't know why, but I think he's lying. Or at least suppressing something important. Lanny will be glad to talk to you. I did my best, but broken hearts. Sort of a mom thing, I finish. Probably. I don't tell him that for me. The only broken heart I've ever really had was from the first man I thought I loved. After the monstrous betrayal of my ex, nothing else can compare, and certainly never hurt as much. Though thinking of Sam leaving comes very close. So does the thought that he and Miranda Tidewell were whatever they were to each other. I wonder if he's lied to me about the sex, or lack thereof. Sam doesn't lie that often, but when he does it disturbingly well. By then, we're passing the McDonald's where we had breakfast, and then making the turn into the motel. We park. Most of the other cars that had been in the lot are gone. Campers heading for the forest, I assume.